at Pennsylvania State University with Dr. Lynch, who, if you've known anything about root research over the last 30 years, he's been a prominent figure. Got his PhD in ecology, was it? Mm-hmm. And then followed him to Nottingham,
yes,
England, to do a postdoc, and then has come back here to the U.S. At the University of Missouri. I think he just almost landed there just a little
July.
While ago. Yeah. So, Dr. York?
Okay. Thank you, Bill, and thank you to the organizers for inviting me, and thank you all for attending. So I'm going to talk about using high-throughput phenotyping to understand root-soil interactions. But to get going, I want to discuss some about the theory behind the rhizosphere, and I really appreciated Bill's introduction to the rhizosphere, and also the definition that he used is one that I really like, because in general I think that people define the rhizosphere based on their area of study. So when we think about the rhizosphere, it's the area in soil where roots are growing. It was named by Lorenz Hiltner in 1904, who studied rhizobacteria and specifically nodules in soybean. And he was thinking about these interactions and thought of the rhizosphere, which he simply defined as the soil influenced by root. So I think that's a very broad definition, and a definition that is useful because it allows all of us to work on our different areas. But so when you think about all these different areas, the first area, which you can probably barely see around here, is a thin yellow boundary around the roots. And this is the area of exudation by roots, and also an area which the microbial community can be drastically changed. And if you think about a larger area of the rhizosphere, you can have depletion of immobile nutrients such as phosphate with a thin depletion zone around the roots. And if you think about a mobile nutrient such as nitrate, it'll have a larger depletion zone. And finally, if you think about water, I think that water probably defines the outer boundary of rhizospheres in general, which is the water depletion zone. So if we zoom in, you can see this a little better. And I recently wrote a review where I talk about the holistic rhizosphere, and the idea behind it is that though we often study these individually, and I do as well, so I'm not saying I'm better or anything like that, but we do need to keep in mind that there are these other areas. And that the rhizosphere is really, it's not just a place, it's a system of integrated and dynamic processes. And one way I wanted to conceptually define this is by use of partial differential equations that basically, this is kind of like fake math, it just gives sort of a conceptual way to understand these different processes. So for example, we have here a function over through time for microbial species, water, soil properties, exudates, nutrients. These are all different aspects that roots do influence. And then what you can see with these functions is that each one of these processes is determined by the other processes. So mathematicians call this a system of equations. And this is useful because then we can see how all these different zones are interacting with each other. And today I'm going to focus on nutrients. So when you think about nutrients in soil, you have something like phosphate that's immobile. It's buffered by soil particles, so it sorbs and desorbs, but eventually it can be taken up by roots. But because of this chemical property it has in conjunction with soil particles, you'll see that there will be thin depletion zones around the root. So take-home message is immobile nutrients lead to thin depletion zones. On the other hand, if you imagine a nutrient like nitrate that can move within water and doesn't sorb with soil particles as much, you'll see that as roots take up nitrate, that the depletion zone can be very large. So that gives us kind of two different modes of nutrient uptake by roots, immobile and mobile. Now consider, what does a root system look like? So just imagine in your head. Let the picture form. And I bet a lot of people may have had a picture like this, like a bowl of spaghetti. But in truth, actually, noodles, spaghetti noodles, could be a good way to model roots. So I actually went out and bought a bunch of noodles to come up with these slides. And all plants grown from a seed will have a primary root, which sometimes people call a taproot. It doesn't matter whether it's soybean or corn, they both have a taproot. That's the first root that emerges from the seed. Over time, that primary root will produce lateral roots. And then if we look at variation within a species, we'll see that some plants have few lateral roots, and some plants have many lateral roots. And so then we can ask the question of what impact does this have on resource uptake? So like I told you, if you consider an immobile nutrient like phosphate, you have thin depletion zones. On the other hand, if you consider a root with many lateral roots, you'll see that it can take up more area of an immobile nutrient like phosphate. So then you might say that having more lateral roots is good for uptake of phosphate. On the other hand, if you consider a resource more mobile, such as nitrate or water, you can see that few lateral roots, because of the large depletion zone, can already do a pretty good job of taking that up. Whereas the plant with many lateral roots, it may be able to take it up faster, but in fact, those extra lateral roots, in some sense, are redundant. So I'm using this to basically tell you that it's not true that more roots is always better. Just like noodles, roots do have a cost. And so you obviously can't have an infinite number of roots. And so then the optimal number of roots will be defined by the fertility of the soil and the cost-benefit, basically. Another aspect we consider with root phenotyping is the angle of roots. So if you imagine that these are basal roots or crown roots, you can have shallow angled roots that are good at taking up a shallow resource, which in fact is most resources most of the time are found in shallow soil, even though we talk a lot about deep soil. So shallow roots are good for things, especially phosphate, because it's so immobile, tends to stay in the shallow soil. On the other hand, if you imagine something like water that can get deeper with terminal drought, or nitrate that can leach down with water during precipitation events, you might think that steep roots could eventually collect all that water. So that was basically my 3-minute spiel on how to be a root biologist, as I see it, basically. And then to get into functional phenomics and how you can use phenomics as a tool, I think, for physiology, basically, how can we study the roots? So high-throughput phenotyping is the central pillar. And basically what that means is that from a root system, we can study things like the lengths of roots, the angles of roots, and the numbers of roots. And then it should be clear from what I said earlier why those should be important. So to quantify the relation to performance, we have to phenotype many hundreds of plants. And so by getting all these measurements across hundreds of plants, we can make associations with plant performance. So basically what I'm proposing is that this is basically a big data bioinformatics approach to physiology, where rather than tinkering with one plant, you're studying hundreds of plants and then trying to make these statistical correlations with the function. For me, it's often been yield and plant uptake, but it could be influences on the microbial community or any other function. So I asked the question, how can we use roots to increase crop productivity? First, we have to identify root phenes or traits. We have to validate their utility. And then we need to breed for roots. And so I'm proposing that we can do this by using what I call the functional phenomics pipeline, which is, I'm just trying to give basically a way to think about what people are already doing, but that generally we think about it as only going towards genetic mapping. But I'd rather say that we can use it to look at functional utility. So first you need to develop an idiotype. So that means that you should hypothesize what type of root system would be good for your environment. And then as part of that means that you have to decide what do you want to measure. You know, do I want to measure the angles of roots, the numbers of roots, etc. Once you come up with that idiotype, you have to develop a platform to measure those traits in a high-throughput fashion. And that's a struggle that probably a lot of people here have dealt with. Once you do that, you can phenotype some type of mapping population that has not only a lot of genetic diversity, but from my standpoint, more importantly, phenotypic diversity. The traditional thing to do is from that to go to QTL analysis or genome-wide association studies. And a lot of people get really excited about finding genes and markers that they say can be used for breeding. Alternatively, I think it's important that we go a step beyond and look at the physiology behind this and select contrast from that population, with which you can go into more detail to study the utility. A lot of this work is very difficult to do, so while we can measure a few properties on 100 lines, we can't measure everything. But if we select contrast from details of that and also the middle, because you'll see that a lot of traits actually have an optimum in the middle of the range, we can study the utility. And in fact, all these relate. As you study the utility, you might actually identify a new phene that you should actually be finding markers for to send to breeders. And all this, for the same reason, this feeds back to idiotype development. As you do this and you figure out more about your system, you may need to figure out new ways to measure new properties. So that's the pipeline that basically forms the core of my work, especially the physiology part of it. So the first example I'm going to give of using this is from work with when I was a PhD student at Penn State. This happened in South Africa in a really sandy soil. I worked with members of the IBM maize population. It's a biparental population. And as I said, like, there had been previous phenotyping work from which I selected what I hoped would be contrasting root systems, but in the end I still had a range. And so that's why in my work I actually prefer a lot of regression techniques rather than trying to categorize them. So first we have to understand a little bit about the maize root system, which emerges from the seed and then produces crown roots from the shoot as it develops, and it produces more and more of those nodes. And then eventually a lot of you have seen in the field the brace roots above ground. Those are the same type of roots, they just happen to have formed above ground. So I use what a lot of people call shovel omics or root crown phenotyping. And my development here was that traditionally people were digging up the root crowns and washing them off and then measuring the angle and stuff on these observable roots on the outside. But when I started my PhD, I'd realized that, you know, these are the youngest roots. They've had the least amount of time to contribute to plant growth. And so I wanted to go more in depth. So I took a picture of the outside of the root system with the younger roots, and I put one root to the side. And from that, I can measure the angles of the roots. The red dots are for the number. And then on the X-size nodal root, I can measure that blue bar at the top, which I call distance to branching, the distance from the shoot to which the first laterals emerge. And then also measure the number of laterals within a fixed distance. And from that, I can get lateral root branching density. And also, I measured the length of three laterals and took the average for to get some type of measurement of lateral root length. But I did this for every node of roots. So I cut away each node and took an image and did the same measurements until I got down to, finally, the seedling root system, which still exists but doesn't look like it's in very good shape. These were taken at flowering. And so just a couple examples of the type of data I could get from this. On the x-axis, we have the node position, where 1 is the oldest node and 7 is the youngest. And you can see blue and red is high nitrogen and low nitrogen. I'm only showing 3 genotypes, and the point of showing those is just to show you the variation that exists among genotypes. So in general, you can see that high nitrogen and blue increases the number of roots. But you can also see that some genotypes, while they start off the same for the younger nodes, they produce fewer nodal roots on the younger nodal positions. For angle, and this is degrees from horizontal, so that means that 40 is more shallow and 70 is steeper. They tend to be more shallow and then get steeper along the node positions, but then there's a lot of diversity for whether plants, again, become more shallow on younger positions or stay steep. So One take-home message from this is that if you're measuring root traits on something like maize only on the outside, you can't assume that all the traits are the same on the inside. And this distance to branching trait has come up a lot in my work, so I show it here, as that it can vary among the node position and among genotypes. One useful outcome of this was we think that nodal root number, several studies have shown that it's important for phosphate, water, and also nitrate. And so one easier way to screen for it may be to just look at the number of nodes, because, of course, there's a positive association between the number of nodes and the total number of roots. It often seems like that maize may actually overproduce nodal roots, and that we want to select for fewer nodal roots. Principal component analysis of the traits among all the nodes shows that the first component is basically made out of sort of density traits, like how many roots there are, the lateral root length, the diameter of the roots. And that you can see, because I've color-coded by the node position, that on the left side you have the older nodes and on the right side the younger nodes. So basically this component can discriminate among the different nodes, whereas nodal root growth angle and lateral root branching density are independent of that component, which means that there's more variation that's not due to the node position. So those may be useful for breeding. As far as associations with plant growth, these are regressions with shoot mass, basically the same results for nitrogen uptake. I found that lateral root branching density on the first node and nodal root growth angle on the second node, lateral root length on the fourth node, and lateral root length on the fifth node were the strongest correlations with shoot mass. One thing to notice again is that these occur on the older nodes, not on the younger nodes. So if you're basing your phenotyping on the younger nodes, then I think that's a mistake. But if you combine all these into a multiple regression model, you can actually get much better predictions of shoot mass with higher R-squares. So my point is that multivariate statistics and using multiple regression can be a powerful way to link together many different traits into more predictive models that more reflect how plants work, because, you know, one phene in one environment may work differently. Like if you have many nodal roots with shallow roots, they'll work differently than many nodal roots with steep roots, for example. I'll talk a little bit about my work in Nottingham, England, where I took some of my same ideas and got the chance to apply them to wheat. So I basically developed a phenotyping platform to look at wheat root crowns. This picture was taken a day after Brexit, so we were all fine in the field, but when I went back to the university, it was like really a sad sight to see, and that's why I'm back here. So wheat development is much different from maize, well, in some sense the same. Okay, so from the seed, we still have the primary roots, we still have a shoot that comes out, and it makes nodal roots, but the big difference is tillering. So you have tillers that come off, and then those tillers make their own nodal roots. It's kind of a bushy mess. So this is a schematic from Betty Klepper back in the 80s. Was, I think, one of the few people that actually tried to look at tillers and their rooting traits. So that was really interesting work for me, and a lot of it was actually done at Nottingham. In fact, Peter Gregory, a well-known root biologist, did his PhD at Nottingham, and I read his dissertation while there, which was related to wheat as well. So what I did is I dug up the wheat root crown, took a photograph, and then I guess I have a one-track mind because I immediately thought, oh, well, I'll split it up and take pictures of each tiller. But from those, I was able to get the angles, the number of shoots, and then the number of roots. And also a couple. But like I said, I split it apart, so then I took the main root system, the first tiller, the second tiller, and so on. And I could tell them apart because the main root system still had the seed inside with the seminal roots, and it's a real tiny little thing that you probably can't see from the audience, but a lot of phenotyping is based on seedling screens, and the root system they're observing is a tiny part of the whole root system. So from this, I've been exploring better ways to display this type of multivariate data. You have the shoot number, roots per shoot, et cetera. And we can show the variation in the population by plotting each genotype in it as a line, and then the parents in red and blue, Rialto and Savannah. and red and blue. And so you can see there's transgressive segregation of these traits so that the progeny can have more variation than you observe in the parents. And we're excited with that because it's a mapping population and we are getting some QTL hits. But for me, I'm actually more excited about making relations among the root traits themselves. That makes me more happy than QTL. So this is what's called a ribbon diagram, and it's useful for showing correlations among multivariate traits. So for example, we can see that crown length is related to many other things. The width of the bar for each trait is basically how many strong correlations it has with other traits. And then the width of each ribbon is the specific association. So for example, crown length is very associated with the total root system width. But you can see there's a thin ribbon going across to the number of roots per shoot that's a much smaller ribbon. So you can fill this in with all the ribbons, and then it's just a lot prettier way to look at a correlation matrix than actually looking at the matrix filled with a bunch of correlation numbers. So one interesting aspect of this that I've taken away, and this is an example of applying this type of phene-based paradigm, where you have something that I would call a phene aggregate, which means that it's basically composed of other phenes. So on the y-axis of all these is root crown width. And a lot of people had used root crown width as something called root plate spread, they called it, and they found associations with lodging in wheat. But what I found is that root crown width has a positive association with the number of tillers, a negative association with root growth angle from horizontal, and a positive association with total root number. So basically, I'm proposing that people studying lodging then should study these more elemental phenes rather than that aggregate to have more tools for breeding. And again, by using multiple regression, I can get more predictive models than any single trait alone. That's in the bottom right with the predicted root crown width from my model. One of the things I was excited to do with this data set was to look at how traits among the tillers and the main shoot relate to each other. So, for example, does the angle of the main shoot relate to the angle of the tillers? And I found out that it does. So that means that there's some, of course, there's a common genetic element among the main shoot and tillers in something like wheat, and that seems to determine partly the root angles. So you see that plants with wide main shoot angles also have wide tiller angles across the main shoot and through tillers 1, 2, and 3. And then finally, for field work at Mizzou, I have a new system there with Felix Fritchie for soybean. Anand is a computer science major, developed a way to program 5 cameras and take pictures of a wheat root crown from 5 different perspectives. And what that allows us to do is segment out the root crown and then pull it out and get a measurements, for example, of the number of roots. And so here's the relationship between the number of roots and a trait that was measured manually, a positive association. And also, 5 cameras do better than 1 camera. So then having multiple perspectives of a root system can be beneficial. So as we develop our phenotyping platforms, we need to keep that in mind. And then due to time, I'm going to have to rush through this X-ray part. But basically, I wanted to phenotype barley roots at the seedling stage at the Hounsfield Center at the University of Nottingham. So you beam X-rays through it and capture an image, and you rotate the sample. It's hard to get the roots out of soil. They're all black and gray, and you have to pick them out. But by using some software developed there, basically we are able to segment out roots from a 3D volume to get a 3D root system architecture. We can get several traits, like the total volume of the root system, the lengths and angles of the roots. And we did this for several different lines. And you can see there's a lot of variation, both in the angles and volume of the roots. The main point here, I guess I'll say, is that we did wind rhizo measurements as well, and we're able to verify that the CT scanner can pick up most of the roots that wind rhizo is picking up. And in the end, we're able to identify these mutants. These are mutant lines from Italy. There's very geotropic ones and ones that are more shallow. So we were able to confirm these phenotypes. And lastly, in this phenomics pipeline, I think it's really important to include simulation modeling. And that's basically so that you can confirm your hypotheses and also generate new ones. So for example, we're doing in Nottingham, this is work I'm doing with Nathan Meller there with SimRoot, which I had also used during my PhD, is that we're pulling in those 3D root systems we scan and putting them into the model and then simulating the uptake by that scanned root system. So what that looks like is you have a root system growing and lateral roots emerging, and then in red was high nitrate, and then in blue, low. So we can simulate the uptake of nitrate by that root system over time. And so by doing this, it's a way that we can predict the uptake ability of different phenotypes by combining both CT scanning and simulations. And I'll end just with saying that I want to challenge people to think about in the future. So now we're starting to be able to scan these roots. But what if I told you this wasn't a simulation, that we had actually CT scanned the nitrate concentrations around the root? That's not true. I'm saying what if. And I want people to think about in the future if we can do things like that, just how amazing that it would be. So with that, I'll highlight my main collaborators, especially my postdoctoral supervisors and Jonathan Lynch, my PhD advisor. And also I'll invite you to follow Root Biology News on Twitter that I run as a service to the community to keep up with root biology. Thank you.